Got a lot of material I want to try to cover tonight. Wasn't enough in a single chapter of Muscle and a Shovel 28, so I tried to add 29 tonight. 29, there's kind of too much material, you know, to do it one night, so we're a little in trouble there. But I do want to take, even with the rush that I expect to be in, a little bit of time to ask you to fulfill this passage, Romans 12. This morning I saw the list of announcements that Ron had before the assembly, and so I did not add one that I'd like to take just a moment to tell you about tonight. Dawn and I first met a family up in Washington, Oliver and Nancy Peter Contessi. The last name is hyphenated. It's Peter Contessi, one name, French, I think. I'm not sure, but Oliver and Nancy have suffered a loss yesterday that is just catastrophic. They're among our very best friends. He's an elder in the Monroe congregation, a man whose faith and whose heart is just unparalleled. He's just a magnificent man. His wife, of course, also a giant of the faith. They have two sons. They're 22 and 20. The younger boy I had a particular affinity for myself. Somehow he and I just kind of struck it off, you know, and so we'd been close through the years. And 20 years old, for the first time, he left home last Wednesday. Said goodbye to his parents, went down to San Bernardino, California to begin a job with the railroad. And when he got down there, Thursday was his first day, kind of an orientation sort of thing. On Friday, he started vomiting throughout the day, and they took it that it was probably a result of the extreme heat change. It's over 100 degrees down there, and coming from northern Washington, you know, not used to that kind of heat. On Saturday, the third day he was on the job, about noon, he suddenly went completely berserk. And he just lost his mind, and he started throwing tools, and there was nothing that the other workers could do but to subdue him. And then after they finally were able to stop him, his heart stopped, and he died. They're thinking that this may be a result of some thyroid problems that he's had throughout his life, and then the extremely heavy work with the railroad, and the heat, you know, that was involved in all of that in the couple of days that he was there. But it's just a gigantic tragedy. And so try to keep in your prayers, if you will, the next few days. Oliver and Nancy would be the easier names to remember. Peter Contessi actually is the last name. But as you've heard so often, you know, no parent should outlive their children. This is a pain that is just beyond description. You know, some of you in this room have experienced this. And without the least bit of warning, you know, and at the age of 20, you just cannot be prepared for such a thing. So for Oliver and Nancy's sake, I want to weep with those who weep, be remembering them in your prayers. That said, we still need to plunge into the material that we'll be looking at tonight from this book called Muscle and a Shovel. Does everybody have a copy? You raise your hand if you do not have a copy here in the room tonight. Everybody's got one, I think, yeah. Okay, if you don't, you know, there's some here. But this book's familiar to us now. We're starting the 28th chapter. Simply a tool to help people to understand what we are about as Christians. Has a wide variety of various doctrinal considerations here, studies that deal with topics that the Bible does and that we, therefore, as Christians, hold very dear, but also very distinctly as members of a local group that believes the Bible is a pattern, that it's not just, you know, here to tell us about morality and everything else doesn't matter, but that it is a pattern for all things that we are to do in our relationships as Christians, how a local congregation is to function. And so we've been studying this in some detail and have come now to this 28th chapter, which is called Don't Ever Call a Man Reverend. The book's been most useful, brought a number of people to Christ already here locally as well as many other places. And so we're just trying to understand it and to use it as another tool to just interest people in the study of the gospel. The term reverend, of course, is used with great frequency in the religious world to designate certain men as being superior in some sense to the rest of the congregation. It's a title that is given to them to distinguish them from everybody else, to bestow upon them a rank that the others have not attained to yet, to separate them from the rest. Typically, the terms we use are clergy and laity, the clergy being those that have these titles and are therefore somehow to be respected above others. and then the lady being, you know, the run-of-the-mill person in the pew. Now, in this study, we're going to be looking at something which he also did last week. So if you're looking at your pages on chapter 28, these are not the pages that I have on the screen. I wanted to just say one thing very quickly from the lesson that we had last time on Wednesday night. If you were to glance at pages 240 and 241, in my book, I put these blue dots around. I highlighted just the question marks that are on those pages. Again, in chapter 28, I didn't single it out, but I want you to just watch how skillfully that this Randall Edges, as he is working with this young man, Michael Shanks, employs the use of questions. And so, for those of you that may not have a book, or, you know, if you do, look in this first section. You said you were a musician, didn't you? Randall asked, yeah, well, what instrument do you play? Play several, and he lists them, you know. And then the last question, the block is, do you know any Coltrane? So he's asking about a particular artist. Those questions, of course, have nothing to do with the Bible. But they do help a person to relax and to make a friendship, you know, and therefore to be more receptive to what you have to say. So it's just a skillful thing that he does right there. Then, as you look over on the other page, page 241, Randall opened his Bible. Mr. Mike, we either do what God says or we don't do what he says, right? That's a simple question, but it sets the stage. Do you care about what God says? Do you want to do what God says? Then he says, let's look at verses 18 and 19. Mike, would you read it out loud for us? Who's he asking to read the passage? The person that he's studying with. Once again, you're helping that person to get this material into their minds, to be considering it themselves. If you don't practice this yourself, I highly recommend it. You will always get something slightly different out of reading anything out loud as opposed to reading silently to yourself. There's just something about connections that are made in the mind that will cause you to see it in a slightly different light. It's very, very useful to read out loud. Try to do that as much as you can. Well, that's what he's doing. He's asking the man, read the passage, read it out loud. And then he says, what kind of music does Paul instruct the church to use in this verse? Well, last topic was about instrumental music, chapter 27. But he hasn't taught anything. He hasn't suggested anything. He just asked the man to read the verse and tell him what he sees. What he sees is obvious. There aren't any instruments there, so he responds. You go to the next page, 242. Randall asks, what kind of music does Paul instruct the church to use in this verse? He's given a second verse. Well, same thing. You come down, Mike, what did the Lord use in the communion meal? And that's right. Why not use meatloaf and iced tea? Jesus didn't say we couldn't use them, did he? Well, now he's using these questions in a similar manner that he did before, but he's also employing the objection that the man had used earlier in a form that causes him, using that question the way he does, to realize that the objection the man had asked, you know, offered earlier is incorrect in a different context. So it's probably not correct in the use of instrumental music either. And so, since we're trying to understand not just the doctrinal aspects of this book, but the brilliance of this personal worker, just the magnificent manner in which he so wonderfully helps people to both understand and to accept what the Bible teaches. Trying to force it down into that empty can that is their head, you know, like that, usually doesn't work out very well. And so I'm hoping that you'll pay attention to that as we go through the book. I'm making special notice of it tonight. But, you know, it's just constant. He is just the master user of questions. God gave Noah specific. He told him to make an ark out of what kind of wood? Okay, right. Now, if Noah would have used oak or pine instead of gopher, you know, what would have happened? Well, so when God specified gopher, did that exclude every other kind of... Each time he asked the man to reach his own conclusion... But, you know, it's the right conclusion. And you'll always believe something more firmly and clearly if you reach that conclusion on your own than having somebody else hand it to you. And then again, would you read the verses out loud for us, please? And then the same attitude that Nadab and Abihu had, what happened to them? Just asking the man what he reads on the page. Mr. Mike, did you know there were no instruments of music in the Lord's church for several hundred years after the birth of the church? Did you know? Is one of the most innocuous, that is non-threatening, and wonderfully useful introductions to a question you'll ever find. Did you know that? Yes, I did. No, I didn't. But whichever it is, you've got an interaction taking place there that you'll find very helpful when you're working, you know, with your friends. So I just wanted to touch on all that before we got to chapter 28, which by and large, you know, I really like. There's just one thing I'd like to take a minute with. So everybody, come on over to page 252. Excuse me, page 252. And in the block there, so you can locate it on the page. See you in the morning, Reverend, I said to Randall as I passed by him on the way out. Wait up, Mr. Mike, said Randall. Yeah, I turned to look at him. Well, my friend, don't ever call a man Reverend, Randall said. He wasn't criticizing, nor was his tone harsh, simply instructing. What's wrong with that? I laughed. The only place you'll find the word reverend in the Bible is in Psalm 111, verse 9. He sent redemption unto his people. It's the indented italics. There he hath commanded his covenant forever. Holy and reverend is his name. Reverend is an adjective describing the name of God. It is intended and used for God alone. Now, this is only the third night that I've ever had any kind of objections with the book. Love the book, it's a wonderful book. But tonight we are going to look at a couple of objections where I think really doesn't quite, you know, get this properly. Reverend is an adjective describing the name of God in that passage. Then he takes it too far, brethren, if the word intended and used for God alone. Now, again, I think it's just an oversight. He wasn't a great student. This is 25 years ago, and he's reworking it, you know, from notes that are 25 years old. But that is much too strong. And it's just simply not the truth. It's a word intended and used for God alone. It's just not so. The Old Testament word here is pronounced Yahweh, as you can see. I just lifted this from, I forget which dictionary it was now, a primitive root. It means to fear, to revere, to cause, to frighten. In the King James, it's translated affright, afraid, dreadful, you know, reverence this one time, or reverend this one time. But brethren, it's used 328 times in the Old Testament. And one of those is in Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 3, which says, every one of you shall reverence his mother and his father. The same attitude that's in Psalm 111, everyone is commanded to have for whom? See, for your parents. It's not a unique word. It's not a holy word. It's not a capitalized word. It's not a word that's reserved just for God. The rest of the verse says, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. So God's name is reverent. That is, it should be feared. It should be revered. It should be respected. It should be treated with very great honor. It should not be trampled the way that it is typically and constantly in our society. We as Christians ought to rise up against that, try to stop people from using the Lord's name in a common or in a profane manner. That's, you know, terrible. It's just unacceptable. And who's going to defend that name if not us? So we want to stand up against that. But let's not just take this, you know, quite this far. It was not a word that was intended and used for God alone. It's used 328 times in the Bible. It just means to have proper respect for whomever it is that you have that respect. Now, in the 253, there at the bottom on page 253, it says, now that you mentioned it, I said, I had a minister get a little irritated with me during one of my repair calls when I didn't call him reverend. Now, in the rest of the material here, he's doing a fine job, and he'll fully accept what he's saying there about not making distinctions between clergy and laity and not trying to teach that anybody is by nature to be respected or held above anybody else in a given local congregation. So I had a minister get a little irritated during one of my repair calls when I didn't call him reverend. You will certainly find that in the denominational world. They want those titles because they want that respect. But brethren, I had not been a Christian more than a year when I was walking through a church building much like this one. And I called one of my brothers by name. He was the preacher for the congregation. And I said, Norman, And I was just calling out to him. We were the only two guys in the hall, kind of a long hall. I was just asking him to wait up so I could talk to him. He continued walking. Norman. And he continued walking. When I finally caught up to him, he said, "I am Brother Norman. I do not respond to Norman." So what was he doing? Same thing that we're crying out against in this chapter, and should. Brother is not a formal title. It is not something that I get or the elders get and you don't. It wasn't ever used as any kind of a title, and never used the way we do today in your Bible. It's Brother Paul, as an adjective that describes the relationship as a brother. He was never Brother Paul. And that may sound like a subtle, maybe not much of a difference, but it's a profound difference. It's the difference between assigning a title and not. We don't have any titles in Scripture. So by and large, chapter's, you know, okay, but let's just recognize, brethren, there's a lot of this very same thing being done among us, and it really ought to stop. So if you think of the word brother or sister with a capital S, you know, and it becomes a title, maybe unconsciously, we need to fight against this, you know, as much as we are in the chapter here. And finally, on page 253, Mike, Jesus said in Matthew 23:9, "Call no man your father upon the earth, for one is your father which is in heaven." Jesus was talking about using the term as a spiritual title. He wasn't talking about calling your biological father dad. You can call him father, of course. Then, next page, to use the word reverend as a title is very similar to men who wear the title of father in the Catholic Church. I see that, I agree. Randall said, even the Apostle Peter, when Cornelius fell at his feet to offer him worship, told Cornelius to stand up, for he too was also a man. Very important passage. It'll be quoted again in the next chapter, Acts 10:27. I was asked this week by, as a matter of fact, Michael Milbratt, who I've been studying with, direct result of his book, which the Carters left in a public place. He picked up, read, contacted us. I have no doubt he'll become a Christian soon. We're still studying. But last time I met with him, he said, "What should I call you? Should you be called Reverend or Pastor?" I said, "You call me Larry." He said, "Well, but I want to show the proper respect." "Okay, then call me Larry. You can be my friend, but I'm not going to be in any way, you know, somehow sanctified, you know, set above you in any way. We're all in this together. We are all Christians. We are all of us doing the best we can without trying to distinguish, you know, any special system or setup. It's going to demand that you have to treat me with some kind of extra, and in most cases, I think, unnecessary and unearned respect." Now, well, let me back up here one pitch. There we go. Now, let's go to chapter 29, which titles on page 255. The rest of it's going to be on that 56 and 5, of course, the actual thing. Before we get started on this, brethren, let me say, and this is just profoundly important to me. If you ask me what is, in my opinion, the single most important thing that distinguishes churches of Christ and Christians from the religious world at large, okay, it is that we grant each other freely the right to study the Bible and reach our own conclusions, because we don't have some pastor or anybody else, you know, who's set above us in some special manner, and that tells us what to believe and practice. This makes us profoundly different than everybody else. They just have to believe what they're taught. We are constantly encouraging that you think for yourself. The reason I say that this evening is that I want to play this card first so that you don't hang me after I teach this chapter. Okay? Because I've reached some different conclusions myself. I do not believe in a one-man pastoral system. I also do not believe that what he taught in this chapter is correct. I've never in my life, 40 years as a Christian, nor in my preaching career, which is about 37, you know, taught on this subject until tonight. That's how much I trust you. But there is a view among us that is presented in this chapter that I really think is just quite incorrect. So for the first time, I'm just going to admit it. I don't buy it. what makes us different is you won't either fire me or stone me, right? Okay, I reached a different conclusion here, but let's talk about it. I'm not asking anybody to change their mind. I just want us to think freely tonight about the arguments that are made in this chapter. So let's read it carefully, what he has to say now. Go on to page 256. You can see the material there. Read it in your own book. Starts with the part that says, no problem. All right, what would you like to talk about? What you said as I was leaving the office yesterday, the Church of Christ doesn't call their preachers pastors. What's with that? Randall opened his Bible. The term pastor comes from the Greek word poimen, or poimano, poimino, and it means shepherd. Totally true. New Testament also calls them bishops and overseers. Two different words, totally true. Pastor, shepherd, bishop, overseer, and elder all refer to the same office and the same person, beyond all doubt. Our English word for pastor, which comes from those Greek words, poimen, is found only one time in the New Testament. Let's turn to Ephesians 4:11. James read it for us here tonight. So he gave some apostles, some prophets, and some evangelists, some pastors and teachers. By the way, who did he ask to read that? See, he asked Mike, the guy who studied with, to read it. Okay, so the bottom of the page, first Randall began. An evangelist is a herald, a proclaimer of the gospel to the lost. Notice that evangelists and pastors are two separate offices. Certainly they are. They're not one and the same as people are led to believe in denominational churches. Second, a one-man pastoral or shepherd system is completely unscriptural and sets the framework for the abuse of power, corruption, and leading away entire groups of believers. I cut in. You mentioned during our study Tuesday that each congregation of the Church of Christ was independent of the rest, self-governed by pastors or elders. So the preacher doesn't make the decisions? Is that what he said? I asked, trying to remember our previous conversation. Yeah, that's right, replied Randall. So the preacher's not the pastor, I asked. No, Mr. Mike, New Testament reveals that the evangelist and the pastor are not the same man. And again, this is all absolutely so. And brethren, I'm sure you all know this. And that's why I'm going to focus on really kind of a very academic, little narrow thing this morning, or evening rather. It's your fault. You did that to me tonight, didn't you? It's more. It's evening, not morning. But, you know, by and large, you know, I certainly agree with everything that he's saying right here. Now, let's go down to this next part, though. And there was always more than one pastor at each congregation in the Bible, I question. Absolutely. Just as Paul and the apostles commanded, he answered. Could you show me where this is found in the Bible? I wanted to see for myself. Certainly, Mr. Mike. Randall began searching for his first verse. But you may want to write the references down because we're going to look at several on this topic. Grabbed an ink pen, took notes. He took me to the verses, and here they are in your book. Make sure you highlight these. They're already in your book. You don't have to, you know, write them down, but highlight them there. And then after we're done tonight, you know, I'm begging everybody, please go and have a look at those. See what I'm about to, you know, suggest, and how you feel about it, and because I'm going to present some ideas here that you maybe haven't heard before regarding those verses. Final paragraph on 257. In these passages, the Bible reveals that elders, or pastors, governed each congregation. There were always a plural number of elders, never just one. Pastor was the same thing as an elder. Pastor was not the evangelist. Last sentence again. Pastor was the same thing as an elder. Totally so. Bible's very clear. Pastor was not the evangelist. Totally clear. Agree completely. My problem, personally, here, is the idea that there were always a plural number of elders, never just one. That is universally held among us. I don't think it's so. I don't think the argumentation holds up. So I'm going to present what I think I see there. You see what you think about it too, and then nothing's going to change. It's an academic study. I'm not going to push for this view that I've got. All I'm saying is I've just reached some different conclusions here. The question is whether or not the Bible teaches that it would be wrong to ever have a congregation in which there was only one elder. Suppose that three of our four elders are driving home tonight, get in a car crash, and they die. Does the fourth remaining elder have to resign? He's no longer qualified because the Bible teaches that you cannot have a single man as an elder. Is he immediately disqualified and may no longer serve? because the other three got killed? That's the question. Okay? I don't think so. I don't see any reason whatsoever why the man would have to resign, why he would have to lay down, you know, these responsibilities. My personal opinion. So, let's think about those verses, which is that same area. For those of you that may not have a book, these are the verses that we're going to look at right here. And just ask ourselves if these verses really teach what he suggested that they did. And before we go any farther, let me, be emphatic. Every single one of these verses is going to provide the word in the plural. I'm not denying that every place you read about these elders, there was a plurality. What I'm asking is whether or not that demands that there must be a plurality. This is what I cannot accept, not now in about 25 years, I guess. There'll be no more slides. I just want to look at each and every verse. So open up your Bibles now. You read along with me. And you've all heard this, I know, all of your lives, and so have I. And so let's just think about these verses and what do they, in fact, actually say. So, first one is in Acts 11. Turn to Acts 11 and verse 30. Acts 11, 30. It's the last verse in Acts chapter 11. This they did, sending it in charge of Barnabas and Saul to the elders. So, a collection has been taken up. A problem is being addressed. Messengers are carrying the money to the congregation where the problem resides. The money is given to whom? Given to the elders. What do we learn from that passage? That the congregation to which it went had more than one elder. Does that verse in any way, shape, or form tell us that the congregation would have been in error if it had no elders? Well, no. It doesn't address no elders. The congregation, historically, just a fact, had a plurality. Does that verse teach, if they'd only had one elder, that it would have been wrong for him to function in that capacity? No, because it's a historical statement. They sent it to a congregation that had elders, plural. It doesn't teach anything from a doctrinal standpoint about what ought to be right or wrong. It's just saying there was a group of men there. There was more than one there. That's all that it says. Let's not make more of it than that. Now let's come to Acts chapter 14. The fact that universally, brethren, in every place we find a plurality of elders, I'm questioning as to whether or not that demands that there must be a plurality. We've already talked about this. The fact that every time you read about the Lord's Supper, it takes place in an upper room, does not demand that we have to build a second story, does it? There's no exception in the Bible. Every place you read about the Lord's Supper, they're in an upper room. I understand that to be coincidental, unnecessary, though it is a universal fact in the verses that are given. I don't take it as fundamentally necessary in order to partake of the Lord's Supper. This is the same conclusion I'm reaching with the plurality of elders. Maybe a historical fact that they had that many, but it's not addressing whether or not you had to. Now let's come to Acts chapter 14, though, because that kind of goes into a different category. This one says, verse 23, when they had appointed elders for them in every church, having prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord in whom they had believed. That's a different category, because now we're appointing elders, and they appointed, it's plural, elders for them in every church. What I've been taught all my life, since 1973, by everybody I've ever met, I'm the only lone guy here in this strange world, so tonight I play the air kick, I guess, but what I've been taught is that that phrasing requires that in each and every individual congregation, there had to be a plurality, and that the use of the plural on elders was not intended to be distributed over all the churches we're talking about and refer to all of the elders that they appointed. No, it can only be understood as there was a plurality in each and every individual group. So I'm talking about all the ones they appointed, it's talking about each and every individual one. Now I believe this, for some years, and it looked really good to me. And then, it hit me pretty hard one time, though. And I want you to look at the verse, brethren. Now look at verse 23, Acts chapter 14. And when they had appointed mayors in every city, having prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord. Having appointed postmasters in every city. How many mayors do we have in every city? Only one. How many postmasters do we have in every city? Only one. How many other offices can you think of where we only have one? But because we have many cities, we speak of a plurality of postmasters and we speak of a plurality of mayors. I have not been able to determine in my studies that this passage limits itself to a plurality in each congregation, so that if you only had one, it'd be a mistake and a violation of God's will. I think it's just being used the same way we use it when we talk about mayors. There are kings in every country. Well, yeah, there's a lot of countries that have kings. How many kings do they have in each country? In most cases, they only have one. I think we went too far. It was an argument that kind of lent itself to a view that we'd already established, maybe, and now we're using it to support that argument. Brethren, this terminology, so far as I can discover, and I'm more than happy, willing to study with anybody. I've talked to some Greek, you know, students about it. I just don't see that as being necessary. And that's a very important passage, because ultimately it's really only one of two that you could cite as not being just the historical fact that that church had a plurality. This is a passage that goes to, how do you set it up? How should it work? So look at it again. When they appointed elders for them in every church. I think the elders is plural because it's talking about all the elders that they appointed. And there were elders, at least one, in every church. What if it had said, they appointed an elder in every church? Would that require that you could not have a plurality? Think about these things. I think it's being used in a more general sense. Now, I spent a lot of time on that one. Let's go to the next one, which is only in chapter 15, next page. And in this case, we can go really very fast. In the next page, chapter 15, verse 2. Paul and Barnabas had great dissension and debate with them. Brethren determined Paul and Barnabas, certain others, should go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders concerning this issue. Now, in the list that he gave you, I guess I could go back to that. In the list that he gave you here, all of these in chapter 15 fall in the same category. They're talking about the group of elders at Jerusalem. There's more than one elder at Jerusalem. That's a historical fact. But you can look at the verses now, verse 4, verse 6, verse 22, verse 23. They're not talking about how many elders you must have. They're not talking about placing them there. They're only talking about these are the guys that got involved in the discussion. So those passages don't help us. Chapter 16 and verse 4, while they were passing through the cities, they were delivering the decrees which had been decided upon by the apostles and elders who were in Jerusalem. Well, it's the same group of men. That doesn't bear on our topic here. So let's come to Acts chapter 20 and look at verses 17 and 18. From Miletus, he sent to Ephesus and called to him the elders of the church. When they come to him, he said to them, you yourselves know from the first day I set foot in Asia how I was with you the whole time. And once again, nobody's questioning. He had more than one elder in Ephesus. Questions whether or not he might have had only one elder in Ephesus or no elders in Ephesus. We've all agreed that you can have a church without any. I'm just wondering, quite not so sure that the reasoning we used to get to the idea that you could never have only one was really biblical. It seemed wise to us. It looked like it would avoid problems. You know, one man would have too much power. He might lead people into apostasy. He might become a pope. All those would be bad things. My answer to all those bad things is what you see at the end of the chapter. If the man is qualified according to the biblical requirements, then you don't fear that he's going to become a pope. If you think he's going to become a pope, then he doesn't meet the qualifications and don't put him in. But if he meets the qualifications, you shouldn't have any fear about the doctrinal error he's going to lead you into, or about, you know, the mistakes that he's going to make, lead everybody into apostasy and all this kind of thing. Any man can make mistakes, and many elders have and have led people into apostasy. Have you never heard of a congregation that had more than one elder and they agreed among themselves to lead a church into apostasy?
Did the plurality prevent the apostasy? No. It happens all the time with pluralities too.
So we had a reasoning that seemed safer, and I grant it's always better to have more. I'm just not seeing that the Bible demands it. Now, in Titus, though, this is the other passage that's going to really help us with this question, because it's the only other one really that goes to the question of how many and whether or not it would be incorrect to not have that many. So let's go to Titus in chapter 1. In Titus chapter 1 verse 5, unfortunately, we've got exactly the same structure that we had in Acts 14:23. I left you in Crete, that you might set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city, as I directed you. This man's given the authority to appoint elders in every city. Because there's a plurality of cities, there will be a plurality of elders. Whether or not there's a plurality of elders in each and every individual city, I do not believe the Greek says. I don't believe it demands that. I think the plurality is because it speaks of all the cities and not of any individual one. As a matter of fact, and like for you, look closely at this. In verse 5 it says, "For this reason I left you in Crete, that you might set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city as I directed you." Everybody look carefully at your Bible. Do not deviate. Put your eyes on verse 6. And I want to read it to you, and I want you to look at it. "Namely, if any two men or more be above reproach." See, verse 6. "Appoint elders in every city as I directed you. If any two men or more be above reproach." Does any Bible have that? No. And no Bible I've ever found has that. Nor does the Greek have that.
What it says, almost universally, there's very few exceptions, it says, any man. If any man meets these requirements, he should be appointed as an elder. Unless we've decided there's only one. And then he may be a man that meets those requirements, but we've decided that it's better to have no elders than to have one. I believe that's a mistake. I believe it is always better to have a qualified elder than to have no elders at all. And I've seen many congregations go years with a qualified elder who never became an elder. A man is qualified because we have decided that it'd be too dangerous to follow God's instruction and appoint this man, even though we freely admit he meets the qualifications. Whenever, brethren, you stand before God and you say, "The man meets the qualifications, but I am not going to let him serve." And then the question comes back, well, why? Because there has to be more than one. I think you're on really shaky ground. Now, I didn't think so years ago. I thought this, like everybody does. Now, at this point, I want Don Bassett to raise his right hand, solemnly swear, I will never tell anybody in Tennessee what I heard from Larry. Please don't tell anybody. Because, brethren, I know this is just really sacred to us as Christians. I've never seen it different. Everybody believes you have to have a plurality. I don't buy it. I think we only have one mayor in every city. Now I can't find anything else in the scripture that requires more than one mayor. And it makes me exceedingly nervous to stand in the face of Titus 1 and decide that I will not allow a man whom God has qualified to serve, because I think I don't trust him. Well, if he meets the qualifications, then you ought to trust him. Okay? I'm so afraid. This one, I know, is just really important. You know, it's been one of those fundamental principles among us. So all I'm saying tonight is, just think about that. I remain unconvinced. Is it always better to have more than one? Sure it is. Does the Bible require it? I'm not convinced. I just never been convinced. Okay? There's tons of material on the internet and elsewhere. You know, you can go think about it yourself. I'll leave you with one last passage. That's Ephesians chapter 5, which has nothing whatsoever to say about elders. If you'll please turn to Ephesians chapter 5, and I'll tell you in advance, I'm going to be mean, cruel, harsh, and very facetious. But everybody, you know, come and look at Ephesians chapter 5. I want you to think long and hard about this as you take on, you know, the disorientation that I've just beset upon you.
I want you to see how in verse 25 that it requires each and every husband to have more than one wife. In Ephesians 5:25, does it not say, husbands, so he's addressing each and every single husband, the whole collection of husbands, everyone without exception, love your wives. Wives is in the plural. How many wives then must each husband have? More than one. Is there a soul here who believes it? No. I don't think you should believe it in Titus 1 or in Acts 14:23 either. But I am not about to change a thing. I just got old enough that I didn't care anymore, so I admitted it. I was going to teach on this my whole life because I was chicken. I trust you people. So there it is. I'm just unconvinced. Better to have more, not necessary. If you trust the man, don't forbid what God apparently has qualified him to be. If any man meets the qualifications, in my view, he should be allowed to serve as an elder. Thanks so much for that. Church, no doubt, will shrink by about 25% now. I hope not. Because we're free to think for ourselves. It's not an issue here anyway. We have more than one very capable, very wise, very, you know, sound elders. Glad for it. Appreciate your attention. As always, we offer the invitation if you would respond to the gospel tonight or have a prayer request, some other request that we might help you with, let it be known, please. Come forward, speak with me as we now stand and sing.